Hi there, folks, and welcome to the Photo Wild Podcast.
I'm Annalise Kaler.
And I'm Jared Lloyd. We created the Photo Wild Podcast to blend together the art and science of wildlife photography. Each episode brings you stories from the field, from the technical considerations to the natural history of the subjects we work with. If you want to become a better wildlife photographer, then this is the podcast for you. All right, folks, welcome back to another episode of Photo Wild Podcast. Of course, my name is Jared Lloyd.
And I am Annalise Kaler.
The one and only, and we will be your hosts today.
As we are every day.
As we are, well,
well
not
every episode,
day.
Every episode.
Yes. So on this episode, we want to continue our conversation that we started last time about photographing bald eagles. However, when we sat down to start doing what Annalise's all-time favorite thing is to do in the world and pre-produce...
I just like to be prepared.
You like to be prepared. She likes
I'm
to
a
be
planner.
Prepared.
She, I'm a planner.
You are a planner. So as we sat down and we began to plan out the run of show here, basically, we started to recognize that there is a much, much bigger story involved in what we had originally intended to discuss today. This episode is all about animal behavior.
I absolutely love this episode.
Me too.
You and I, we kind of nerded out, which is our usual MO anyway. But when we were just in that lovely planning phase, we kind of nerded out about how important animal behavior is and just how, you know, I think back to all of the workshops we've done together and all the times that we, you know, have taught different things to different people over the years now. It's all comes down to behavior. And so in the last episode, I mentioned something about how animal behavior, especially with the eagles, they kind of give you a cue about when they're going to suddenly like stop, pivot, and dive down at those amazing fast speeds into the water, whether it's to pluck out a mallard or if they're going to spin into the snow and grab a hare, or maybe they're just going after a fish that's below the surface.
Or they're chasing a gull to steal their dinner.
Right.
Those kleptoparasites that they are.
Yes. You know, all of this behavior tells us something. And as photographers, we like to say like, oh, we are, you know, masters of light maybe. But really, I have always thought of myself as a professional observer. That's what I do with my photography. And maybe that's because I like a more editorial sort of documentary take on it for my own personal style. But as observers, we have this incredible ability, if we want to, in paying attention, see and recognize what animals are going to do. And as photographers, that allows us to capture that and anticipate that behavior much more predictably than just kind of leaving it to chance. And so when I'm in the field, I'm always looking for those visual cues from our subject. In the case of the eagles, one of the things I noticed that we were doing with our photography is, you know, and this happens everywhere. I love birds. Birds are especially pattern oriented. They like to repeat behaviors a lot, patterns that exist across a lot of the same species. So with the eagles here, what would happen a lot of times is an eagle's just like nicely flying by and, you know, not really doing anything. They're not
Can
going.
Can I make sound effects? Flap, flap. No.
Okay. Oh, is that Hollywood calling for those sound effects?
Yes,
they're
it
so
is.
Good. Okay, but no, they
Bollywood.
Just they're just kind of taking their time, and then you see just the subtle, most tiny little head tilt. And that's because we all know eagles have these incredible eyes, right? We get the phrase eagle eyes for a very good reason. And their eyes and all of their superpowers, which I'm not going to nerd out about today because I recognize this is not the bird nerd podcast. Those eyes have spotted something. And that could be, you know, a merganser coming down the, you know, in the water somewhere. It could be a fish or whatever it might be. But that little tiny spot and the way that that eagle tilts his or her head tells me, as the photographer, they've spotted something of interest. Now, I don't necessarily know if that's something, you know, like the latest news magazine on the rack or, no, I'm just kidding. I know because everything revolves around food and sex with animals that eagle has likely spotted their next piece of food. And so when I see that head tilt, that is absolutely when I am making sure to stay on that bird and be ready to track lock focus and be ready to track that bird all of the way down toward their prey and follow through all the way back out. And by watching those little tiny details, you will find that it will do so much for your photography. And specifically with the eagles, with a lot of birds, this is something that all of them sort of repeated. All of the birds that I photographed while we were out had this sort of behavior to them. And that became a predictable and fairly reliable indicator that they were about to dive or they were about to do that really cool thing where they kind of freeze their head in the direction they're going to fly and their whole body like twists up in this amazing like vertical orientation. And then they just plunge either down to the water or into the snow and snatch up their prey for their next meal. I mean, it's truly fascinating to watch, but that head tilt and just being, you know, cognizant of where they're looking, what that animal or that bird is observing, or excuse me, mammal, bird. We did this last time. What that bird is observing will tell you a whole lot about what their next behavior is. And as we started talking about this for this episode, you and I just went off on our tangents, as we tend to do, with just all of the behavior that is so important to us as wildlife photographers and how understanding animal behavior is one of the most important pieces of equipment, if you will, in your photographer's toolkit. You absolutely need to understand. This is something we preach all the time anyway about being a better naturalist, but this is truly something that goes beyond just the Eagles episode. And so I think we're both really excited to kind of dive in to some of the examples that we've come up with and that we talk about, as well as kind of give a little bit of background to it. So,
Yeah, I agree 100%. And, you know, so I grew up playing sports. You know, I played football, I played basketball, I did all that sort of stuff, right? And in playing sports, we always refer to that as telegraphing our intent, right?
Yes.
So when we were playing basketball, for instance, you know, you're always watching your opponent's eyes, because even though their body might be moving one way, their eyes would usually telegraph exactly the direction that they want to go, what they're actually paying attention to. And so that's what I always think about when I'm photographing bald eagles, for instance. Or any bird in flight for that matter. You know, they tend to look in the direction that they're ultimately going to go. They look at the thing that they are, you know, let's say fixated with, you know, so whether that's a salmon, whether that's a, you know, a pintail, whether that's, you know, a gull that's flying by with, you know, a double quarter pounder with cheese from the McDonald's parking lot, right? That bald eagle is obviously kind of tuned in with their eagle eye. And if we are paying attention to that sort of stuff, if we're watching that sort of behavior, then as you said, we can set ourselves up for success to be able to anticipate that behavior. And so this whole study of animal behavior, I mean, we really can't overemphasize enough how important this is to being a better wildlife photography. I mean, seriously, when you and I were discussing this, you know, at one point in time, I said, look, you know, I mean, you can literally just remove everything else off of the table. If you want to be a better wildlife photographer, probably the number one thing that anybody and everybody could do right now today is invest themselves in starting to understand animal behavior. Understanding animal behavior allows us to anticipate, you know, what those animals are going to do. It allows us to predict what we need to do in order to get ourselves set up for those sort of photographs and stuff like that. And in the halls of academia, if I may, the study of animal behavior is called ethology. And I think, you know, with all of my heart, that wildlife photographers should be fully committed to earning their honorary PhD, basically, in animal behavior, in ethology, because that is the secret sauce that is going to make us better photographers day in and day out. And so, obviously, eagles are not the only species that have this kind of unique behavior that we can watch and anticipate, you know, what's going to happen next based upon that. And so, I think that, like, you know, Annalise, probably one of my all-time favorite examples of understanding animal behavior is related back to the northern red fox. Now, northern red foxes, of course, they're all over the northern hemisphere of the world. This is not a species that is, you know, relegated just to the United States or Canada or Alaska or something like that. You know, these are kind of circumboreal species, if you will, all over the northern hemisphere. And red foxes, we have come to discover, and when I say we, obviously, I don't mean you and I, of course.
I wish,
right? No, this was, like, in fact, the study that kind of figured this out, if you will. It was a university study around the world with something like 30 different researchers working on this. And what they found is that when a red fox is facing north or south, right? So magnetic north or magnetic south, they have a success rate at hunting that is upwards of 75 to 80%. Mm-hmm. That is extraordinary when it comes to a success rate at catching food. Now, we should probably back up, and we're going to say that this is in the wintertime, and this is when they're hunting for small rodents inside of or underneath of the subnivian zone of the snow. So they're actually having to hone in, listen to these tiny little noises, just like a great gray owl would, basically, and then measure the distance and actually leap out and pounce head first and paws first, technically, to collapse that subnivian zone around that species of vole or mouse house or whatever the rodent happens to be, and then they kind of dig it out with their mouth from there. And so a 75 to 80% success rate, as long as they're facing north or south. And what we've discovered with that, of course, is that red foxes aren't just listening for those noises. They're actually able to tap into the Earth's magnetic field and utilize that magnetic field as something of a rangefinder. So the sound, of course, will let them know in what direction and the generalized location. But when they actually have to leap out, you know, 5, 8, 10 feet forward and pounce down into the snow, they need to know exactly what that distance is. And so amazingly, they're using the Earth's magnetic field. So what does this mean for you as a wildlife photographer, right? That means that if you see a red fox in the wintertime that's hunting out in an open meadow, you can already guarantee that they are most likely going to have their success at catching prey as long as they're facing north or south. And so that means if you set up on the east or west side of that animal as it's making that kind of grid pattern back and forth across the meadow, listening for voles and stuff like that, then you can set yourself up to take advantage of those kind of really amazing shots that we always like, where it's kind of like the, you know, the stitched together, you know, high frames per second, sort of like, you know,
the red fox leaping into the air, and you're capturing kind of like, yeah, every single sort of movement. And before you know it, you've got, you know, five pieces of wall art that show the entire sequence.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And so some of this, of course, is setting us up to get great wildlife photography. You know, sometimes it's just simply about staying safe. You know, you and I, we live in Alaska. You know, we're around a lot of big animals. Before Alaska, there was Montana and Wyoming for me. Mm-hmm. So, you know, kind of my wheelhouse is working around very large and potentially dangerous animals. You know, so we take a bison, for instance, right? Anytime, every time you're around a bison, or what a lot of people like to refer to as buffalo, even though they're not actually buffalo.
Oh, right? Let's not go down. Okay. We could go down the rabbit hole, both of us.
That is absolutely a rabbit hole. I digress. I'm backing up. I'm just going to talk about bison. Well, there's a saying that we always like to talk about, especially with clients who are in their field and stuff like that. The one thing, the number one thing that you always want to watch out for with bison is their tails. When their tail is in the air, it means one of two things is imminent, either a charge or a discharge. And either way, you want to watch where you're standing, of course. You know, so we talked about this, like, I don't know, maybe two episodes ago or something like that, where we're in Yellowstone, we watched these wolves hunting this, you know, this herd of bison, right? And before, as soon as those wolves stood up, you know, from their kind of what appeared to us to be a nap out in the middle of that open meadow, immediately every single tail went straight in the air with all of those bison, because they immediately understood what those wolves' intentions were. And so they were reading their behavior, and they were immediately communicating back to the wolves exactly how they felt about that. And so when a bison is pissed off, when a bison is going to charge, it sticks its tail straight in the air. You can jump on YouTube and, you know, do a search for like Yellowstone bison goring or something like
just
that.
Just go down the whole Torons of Yellowstone account and you'll see many examples of this.
You'll see a lot of examples of this, right? And like every one of those, like, you know, kind of like shocking, sad, hilarious, you know, as long as nobody gets hurt, of course, you know, videos of, you know, somebody at like Old Faithful that gets tossed, you know, 18 feet into the top of a lodgepole pine by a bison. You watch that cell phone video that's being played and you see that tail is in the air the entire time. And so from that bison's perspective, he has been attempting to communicate this entire time. And if only that Toron, if you will, Taurus plus moron, of course, you know, had recognized what that tail meant, they never would have been tossed 18 feet up into the lodgepole pine like a rag doll, essentially. So sometimes this is about setting ourselves up for great photography. Sometimes it's about keeping ourselves safe. You know, another really cool example that I always love are actually waterfowl. I love photographing ducks, geese, swans, stuff like that. And whether we're talking about snow geese, tundra swans, or various species of waterfowl, oftentimes when you have these birds on the water and they see other flocks of like species, you know, in the air, in the sky coming through, they'll actually start to call out almost as if they're kind of like reaching out with the cell phone and be like, hey, how's it going up there? It's pretty cool down here if you want to circle back around and land on the water, essentially. And while ducks, geese, and swans, waterfowl actually have an eyesight that is far, 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 far more superior to, you know, human eyesight, you know, literally second only to diurnal raptors like eagles and stuff like that, like we, you know, we started the episode out, right? They're actually able able to see these ducks, geese, swans, whatever, you know, farther out than we can. So I can't tell you how many times I've been set up in the marsh photographing waterfowl, and all of a sudden the snow geese all start calling out, or the tundra swans all start calling out. And then, and only then, do I start to hear the sound of other snow geese or tundra swans on the horizon. And it's usually before I ever see them. And then the birds come swooping in. And of course, I've set myself up so that way the light's coming in from one direction, the wind's coming in from one direction, and those birds are basically landing towards my lens. I never would have been prepared for that if those birds hadn't communicated that sort of stuff first. And then probably, if you don't mind, if I just take one more of our list here, forest birds. Now, and I realize I may be kind of stepping on some toes here, you know, since like, you know, you are the
bird nerd.
You're the podcast's, you know, kind of official bird nerd, right? But forest birds, they are such an incredible signal to what is happening in the woods around us. And it's a mixed species thing, which is amazing to me because these birds, they're all basically busy going about their own lives, trying to survive, trying to keep their kids alive or fed or find mates or whatever it is. But there are moments in their life in which they put everything on pause and they all come together for the block party with all the other, you know, avian species in the forest to kind of alert the rest of the forest to danger. So the one and only time that I've had a photographable opportunity with boreal owls was because of all these little forest-dwelling songbirds making their alarm calls, essentially. So they'll do this when there's martens, like the American marten, raccoons, you know, any sort of nest-raiding predator, or any species of, you know, small raptor that actually feeds or potentially could feed on other songbirds and stuff like that. And so, you know, if we're tapped in and we're listening to what's going on, then we can recognize what that behavior is, or we can recognize the fact that you have 5, 6, 7, 8 different species all calling at once. That has to mean something. And if we know what that means, then we can strap on our snowshoes like I did, hike into the forest, and lo and behold, there's a boreal owl. Still to this day, even though I live in Alaska and we're surrounded by boreal owls, technically, I've never had an opportunity to photograph one except for that one situation when I was able to kind of tap into the, you know, the avian social media network with inside of the forest.
The literal tweet.
The literal, yes, I love it. The tweets.
Yeah, it's interesting. And this is another quick example on that, which is, you know, those of you who live in an urban environment, if you have bird feeders, for example, I know you have experienced the situation where the birds are just out there, you know, chatting along, chirp, 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 chirp. And all of a sudden, the cacophony of the songbirds goes silent. And you can just look up and there's almost certainly some sort of predator above. Like this happens all the time with like, you know, red-tailed hawks, red-shouldered hawks, Cooper's hawks, all of the city-dwelling sort of raptors will do this too. And so there's kind of that reverse thing too. You don't even have to be in the forest to pick up on some of these cues from the birds. But birds are a really good indicator, not just to themselves, but to a variety of other species when it comes to just basically letting the entire animal sphere know what's going on. And what comes to mind specifically for me is an example that we experience with ravens and coyotes, well, and carnivores in general, I guess, from all of our other experiences. But the example that comes to mind is a particular situation when we were in Yellowstone a couple of winters ago with the ravens and the coyotes. Now, we had come upon what looked like it was a roadkill bison that the Park Service had then gone ahead and pulled way out into the field like they do with some of the roadkill. So it could be appropriately taken care of.
Appropriated.
Yes,
appropriately. Appropriated.
Yes, so that it would benefit the rest of the species. And as we pulled up on this, we saw a variety of creatures there. We saw a couple of bald eagles. We saw...
There was a golden eagle, yep.
Yeah. And we had, you know, just in general, we had a bunch of ravens. And one of the things, you know, ravens like to scavenge. And one of the indicators for us with those ravens going crazy is recognizing that they're communicating a meat call. These are things that, like ravens specifically, have a call that is just designed to let other ravens know, hey, we've found this, you know, cache of meat. Come to the meat buffet and enjoy and everything else. So, you know, when the eagles hear that call, they know what that means. And they come in and the eagles are necessary because the ravens can't open a carcass or tear flesh on their own. The eagles can come in and kind of tear that flesh for them, start opening up everything for the ravens to devour this find. But the coyotes also hear these calls of the ravens. And as we were looking at the situation, the carcass was still pretty much intact. I mean, there were a couple little rips from the eagles, et cetera, but no other carnivores had yet found this bison and had gone to town on eating it. And so you made a comment as we were kind of approaching with some of our clients, you know, you made a comment, you know, like, we noticed these ravens are doing this. There's no other carnivores that have come in to take care of this bison. Let's just stick around for a little while, you know, give it 10 minutes or so. There's going to be someone coming in here. And lo and behold, if it wasn't just 5 minutes later that the first coyote starts wandering in, crosses the road and comes over to the bison. And then maybe 4 or 5 minutes after that, here comes coyote number two, trotting in from the other direction, having heard the ravens as well. And I think there was even like coyote number three eventually came by, but it was being able to understand that these ravens were communicating something not only to their fellow birds, but to the rest of the forest, that there was a food source here. And those animals like coyotes and eagles and other scavengers and other mammals who are going to take advantage of a roadkill like this, were all clued in to the fact that there was a big, wonderful meal waiting for them if they just followed that sound.
Yeah. And it's so important to understand that, you know, survival in the wild is all about basically being situationally aware. You know, animals, every animal, it doesn't matter the species, the genus, the class, whatever, they are listening to, they are watching, they are reading everything from everybody else at all times. And so, you know, it's animals, and this is, I think this is where we start to kind of segue, right? into the kind of the overstory that I think we wanted to both communicate and discuss with this whole thing. And that's, you know, not just behavior, but communication, animal communication, right? It's important for us to understand that every single animal lives inside of this kind of multicultural, you know, kind of ethnically diverse neighborhood, if you will. And in order to survive in that sort of environment where predators are always encountering other potential predators, where prey are encountering, or prey species are encountering potential predators, where various other animals are constantly coming into contact with each other and stuff like that in these communities, they have to have some sort of universal language that they are able to kind of tap into and read from. And a lot of that comes down to body language in general. Now, with birds are unique because they have these incredible calls. Like you said, you know, the ravens were deafening at that bison carcass, yeah. Right? And that's why I was like, I look around, obviously there's no other, you know, there's no kind of, you know, four-legged predators that have been on this scene or scavengers. It's like, okay, just give it time. Like, everybody can hear this. I can barely even talk to you because of how loud these ravens are. That means that a coyote that's a mile away or half a mile away is hearing this. That means that, you know, a fox that is 3/4 of a mile away is hearing this sort of stuff and they're coming in. So birds are unique in that sense. But quite often, you know, all of this really does come down to body language. I think that we should pause here for a second, right? To understand that while, you know, because this is important as a wildlife photographer, this isn't just body language between animals that they're reading, you know, other wild species and stuff. We have to remember as wildlife photographers, as human beings on this planet, we too are animals. Yep. We are mammals. It doesn't matter what sort of like silly, absolutely asinine and ridiculous, you know, discussions we want to have with ourselves. Like, well, are we really an animal and stuff like that? Every other living organism on the planet recognizes us as a mammal and a predator. We have 2 forward-facing eyes. There is no difference between us and a bobcat or a bear or any other thing that eats other things in the wild, essentially. And so what that means is every single time we lace up our boots, or if you're me, strap on your sandals and then go walk off into the forest, right? We are having a two-way conversation with every single animal out there.
Absolutely.
At all times. And that is such an incredibly important thing to understand. So yes, as a wildlife photographer, it would behoove all of us to, you know, like I said, kind of like start working on our honorary PhDs in ethology, in understanding animal behavior, but it also means that we have to understand our own behavior as well.
Absolutely.
We too are the animals. Yeah. Everything we do, everything we say, the direction of travel, the direction that we look, the noises that we make, the twigs that we snap, you know, how we carry ourselves, our body postures, how tall we stand, whether we sit down, whether we lay down, you know, all of that is being read at all times, from our movements, from our sounds, to even our smells. And my God, we are a very, very, very awkwardly smelling species with all of our chemicals and stuff like that, you know, and all of this is communicating stuff to other animals.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, the other important part to this, you kind of brought up the safety part. It's not only communicating things about us, it's communicating things about our intent. You know, and we have a lot of different ways, even as humans, that we communicate with one another. Like sometimes we just see something and it makes, maybe doesn't, we don't know what it is, but something doesn't feel right. Or, you know, I know instantly if you are in a bad mood. I know instantly if...
Wait a minute. I'm always in a good mood, Annalise.
Yeah. Okay, we'll go with that. And...
Ouch.
No, but we know when something is up, if you will. Like I can look at Susan, my dog, and I can see what kind of mood she's in. Is she wanting to play with me or is she just in this mood of just kind of like ready to chill out for the night? You know, we do this so often that we don't even notice the different observations we make in one another, let alone in the wildlife we photograph sometimes.
Yeah, you know, and so perfect example of this, right? Like, let's turn the lens back on us. Let's instead of looking at wildlife, let's look at the human zoo here for just a moment.
And we are a zoo.
And we are the zoo. The zoo, excuse me. Consider this example, right? You're walking down a sidewalk, you know, in a street in an urban area or something like that. And on the other side of the street, you know, going the opposite direction, let's say there's three teenagers, right? They're laughing, they're joking, they're very much caught up in their own worlds. Probably one of them's checking their cell phone because they're teenagers and that's what they do, you know, and, you know, this is a perfectly normal, relatively benign situation that you're probably not even going to actually direct your full attention to at any given moment. It's something that's going to be processed in the back of your head. Yeah. Teenagers are acting like teenagers. They probably just got out of school. They're walking their way home, right?
Yeah, it's just in the periphery.
You're going to think nothing of this, right? Now, take this exact same example. You're walking down the street, right? Down the sidewalk, I should say. Don't walk in the street. And you have these three teenagers on the other side of the road. And suddenly, they stop. And they, all three of them, turn directly towards you and start staring at you. You glance up and you realize you have, you know, three sets of eyes, six eyeballs all staring into your soul at that moment. And then suddenly, right then and there, they all make a beeline straight across the road with these kind of like rigid postures coming at you. You know, imagine what your emotional experience, or let's say, you know, biochemical experience is going to be in that moment. One, right, like I said, teenagers acting like teenagers, you're not going to think about it. The other, suddenly, this is different. This is unusual, right? All of a sudden, something has happened, something has changed, and their actions and behavior is directly towards you, towards us, and this isn't normal, right? In the wild or in the human zoo, oftentimes, difference equals danger, right? There's a reason that we as an animal, we as a mammal, have this sort of negativity bias, always kind of watching for these little subtle changes in our environment, you know, to know whether or not, you know, somebody's behavior or actions are erratic and are different than what's normal and stuff like that. And we tune into those things and we pick up on those things. And unconsciously, you know, we're making note of those sort of things. And there's nothing subtle about suddenly three people stopping in their tracks and then charging straight towards you across a street. That's going to send every single person listening to this podcast into this kind of fight or flight or fawn or freeze, you know, sort of situation for themselves.
Absolutely. And I think like this is another thing that we don't even notice about our own behavior is what we communicate to other humans. And, you know, when we were kind of talking about this, I was like, ugh, you know, I'm a woman walking down the street. I think about this stuff all the time. I'm always, you know what I mean? I can't wear headphones, things like that. But we all have different comfort levels with what is or is not being communicated to us. And animals are the same way. And similarly, they also have a different comfort level with what we are saying to them. You know, like you were talking about the tail up with the bison, right? We have our own sort of mechanisms for communicating that we're about ready to charge as well. You know, we communicate things whether we want to or not. And it's not always visual. It could be smell, it could be touch or anything. But just even if we don't speak the same language, for example, a chickadee doesn't need to speak nuthatch to understand an alarm call from a nuthatch. They just get it. You know, similarly, we just understand when something isn't right. And with animals as well, we want them to be as comfortable as possible, which means that more than anything else, we need to be aware of our own behavior. This is like an example, or I should say a situation where in wildlife photography, you cannot be situationally aware enough in your circumstances.
Amen, sister.
Yeah, not only for, like you pointed out, safety, but also to get the kind of shots we want to get. And that comes up quite a bit. We do get a lot of questions of, you know, I don't understand, you know, how you were able to get that. And one example that came to mind was a recent experience a couple of years ago you had in Yellowstone, where you had all sorts of close encounters with wildlife when you were out scouting. And the reason those things happen, and the reason you can find yourself repeatedly in these circumstances or up closer to an animal and experiencing something unusual, is because you're super aware of what you're communicating.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, so kind of like, you know, remove the human zoo factor here, right? Where, you know, you're walking down one side of the street and you got the three teenagers on the other side. You know, now imagine you're in the woods, you're in the forest, you're in the wilderness, you're in Yellowstone, wherever, it doesn't matter, you know, and you see an animal and suddenly that animal is just going about its business. All of a sudden you come to a halt, you get excited, you turn, you look straight at that animal with your two forward facing predatorial eyes, and then you make a beeline straight towards that animal, of course, with tripod over shoulder and 400 millimeter or 600 millimeter in camera and all that sort of stuff. What is that animal going to feel? What is that animal going to think? It's the same thing as you being on the opposite side of the road and suddenly those teenagers are coming straight at you.
Difference equals danger.
Difference equals danger. Right, exactly. And so, you know, we as wildlife photographers, we're those three crazy teenagers that are suddenly charging straight at this poor innocent bystander that's just like, you know, I don't know, going about their day trying to get home from, you know, their work at the local waterfall or something like that.
Yeah, and we do this also with other things. So this is something that I talk a lot about, like when I'm guiding bird tours, for example. What I see a lot happen, both with photographers or people who are out just for wildlife viewing, is they'll be, driving along in a car. They see something they want to see, and all of a sudden, slam on the brakes, roll down the windows, throw up the field glasses, you know, start looking at this. And by the time all that happens, the bird has disappeared, right?
Yeah. Oh my
gosh,
yes.
This happens all the time. And we see this with photography as well. And I think, like, again, difference meaning danger, equaling danger. That's a difference. It's not just what we're communicating with our bodies, but the tools that we use, swinging around tripods, you know, slamming on the brakes, revving engines, all of these little cues, whether it's visual or auditory, to the animals are communicating, whoa, this is not what I want. This is, something's going to go down. I don't want any part of it. And we see that all the time. And so just as a little side tip, never just slam on your brakes next to what you want to see. Your success rate will go up simply by being aware of how you're driving when you see something, like whether it's a bird or a coyote in the distance or what have you, by simply just being aware of what your overall impact is with the tools that we use, like our tripods and our vans and everything else.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, how many times, especially when we're working inside of national parks, which of course, you know, in those sort of situations, we're around other people, tourists, photographers, stuff like that. I mean, countless, truly countless numbers of times that, you know, we're photographing something and then all of a sudden, here comes a van, they see what we're seeing, or worse yet, they just see big lenses. And so they slam on the brakes and people suddenly pile out of the vehicle. Well, the animal's long gone at that point. You know, it's because, again, directing that attention, doing something that is completely different. An animal that chooses to live by the roadside is very accustomed to passing vehicles, right? There's a lot of animals that absolutely will not have anything to do with roads. And there's some animals, and we're talking like, you know, a fraction of a percentage here, that do find comfort living near roads for various reasons that, again, is a different podcast story and stuff like that. But in any case, you know, slamming on your brakes, like you said, suddenly jumping out of the vehicle, or even just throwing a lens or a set of field glasses to look at a bird or something, that's different, that's unusual, that's dangerous. Difference equals danger. They're gone. Simple as that. But when we allow the animal the agency to make a decision as to whether or not they're going to engage with us, as to whether or not they're going to find themselves within some sort of like proximity to us, what we find is that changes everything quite often, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, kind of trying to, let's go back to the human zoo example here just for a second, right? Take those same three teenagers and let's say they cross the road 150 to 200 yards down the road in front of us. So that means, you know, this isn't just about the simple fact that teenagers cross the road and so we should be scared, obviously. You know what I mean? It's about communicating intent. And when they're staring at us and they're coming straight at us, they're communicating intent. They cross the road 150, 200 yards down the road. They walk over, they pull out their cell phones, they sit down on a bench or something like that. We are, once again, we're not going to think anything of this. We might log that information, you know, if we're being situationally aware that there's people up ahead and they just sat down over there, you know, but most likely we're just going to continue on our path. We're going to pass right by them, not thinking anything of this obviously benign and complete completely harmless and absolutely normal behavior by these teenagers, right? And same thing when it goes to us being in the field. You know, when we give the animal the agency and the decision as to whether or not they get closer, as opposed to suddenly forcing them into a situation where we're kind of like, you know, literally blitzkrieging straight towards them, you know, through the field, then what we find is the majority of the time, those animals tend to stay on their path. They might adjust a little bit, right? Because we all have our kind of like, you know, our little 2-foot rule, if you will, in terms of our personal space. Bears have their bear bubbles. Every animal has its little bubble around it that it's not super comfortable about other animals being inside of. But in general, what we find is that they tend to just continue on their path. And so, you know, same sort of example, you're in Yellowstone National Park. Let's say you see a coyote or a bobcat that's moving in a certain direction. Instead of slamming on brakes, jumping out and making a beeline straight towards it, like the three teenagers coming at you, you drive on down the road another couple hundred yards, you park, you get out, you move into position, you set up, maybe you set down and get down. And this gives you the opportunity, of course, to kind of figure out where you want to be for the light, where you want to be for the background. And then you allow the subject to decide whether or not they want to continue moving in that direction. That is how you set yourself up for success in the field. You don't go straight at the animal. You get way on down out of the way, and then you set yourself up. And you don't sneak around and do it. You know what I mean? Again, let's take the teenager example, right? Like if all of a sudden I see that teenager 100 yards down the road suddenly like dive behind a trash can and like peer out at me and then run to behind a parked car and then like look over it and then, you know, jump behind like a lamp post or something like that, I'm just gonna be like, oh, hell no, I am not going
that's
in that direction.
That's
a lot different right there. I think I'm more comfortable with the three people coming across a street directly right at me than that sort of stuff. And so for a wild animal, suddenly seeing something like that, especially with, you know, a large mammal, 2 forward-facing eyes, seeing a predator, that animal, us, is doing exactly what predators that want to stalk and kill that other animal does, you know? And so therefore, it's like casually walking out, getting into position, settling down nice and low, setting up your lens, getting your exposure set, you know, having this nice, calm demeanor about yourself. It's going to give that animal the opportunity to assess the situation, make a decision on its own, whether or not it should continue in this direction or veer. And 9 times out of 10, that animal is going to continue in the direction. And if you don't mind, I want to use one example of the bobcat in Yellowstone National Park, because I think this is a really, really, really good one. So many years ago, watching a bobcat work its way along the edge of a river. I should actually say, we didn't even know there was a bobcat there. All I knew was that there was some sort of predator that was down along the banks of the river. And the only reason I knew that is because I saw a flock of ducks jump. And then another minute later, another flock of ducks jump like 50 yards down the river. And then another minute, 2 more ducks jump again, further down the river.
Yeah, something's coming.
Something's coming. That's all I needed to know. That's being situationally aware. That's reading animal behavior. And that's being able to anticipate that something's happening. So that's when I pull out the field glasses and we're sitting there. Actually, I was standing there and, you know, kind of watching, and a little gap in the snowbank along the edge of the river suddenly revealed that there was a bobcat that was walking down the river. And if we maneuvered our way, you know, back across a bridge and got into position, we could actually get down into the snow, set up, and give it, you know, I don't know, 20 minutes or so, that bobcat would end up coming straight towards us. So that's exactly what we did, right? The bobcat was far out there. Bobcat had no idea that we were here. We went down, we got waded into like 4 feet of snow or whatever and kind of set up, not because we were trying to hide ourselves or anything like that, just we wanted to be eye level with the snow with our lenses when that cat, came around the bend. And the situation was perfect. It was a gorgeous setup because once that cat came around, that cat's going to see us kind of hunkered down in the snow. And I just assumed like, okay, we were here, we're not moving, we're not chasing him or anything like that. He's probably going to pause, you know, assess the situation. And then most likely he's just going to work his way around us. No big deal. We're going to get some great shots as he comes up along the river. We're going to get some great photographs as he crosses over the snow and up into the edge of the forest. And then, you know, we'll let him go, obviously, as he's just kind of skirting around us. Well, the cat did all of that, sort of. The cat came into view. The cat saw us. The cat sat down. The cat assessed the situation. Then the cat proceeded to walk up onto the snowbank, which I kind of thought he was going to do, like I said, and kind of circumnavigate us. But then the cat just walked straight towards us, literally just did his own little beeline straight in our direction and finally passes by us within about 10 feet from where we're sitting. Now, we're shooting with like 600 millimeters with an 18-foot minimum focusing distance. That means, if you can imagine, we're sitting in the snow and here's a bobcat and it's too close to be able to focus on. Like,
oh,
all we
what
can do
problem.
Is sit there is like, you know, just like drool. And of course, the drool's freezing into our beards and mm-hmm. stuff like that, obviously.
Your beard, not my beard.
My beard, not your beard. But I think that is such a great example of, you know, giving that animal agency to make its own decision as to whether or not he wants to continue to move forward. And, you know, now juxtapose that with the one situation we found, I no names, no locations, all that sort of stuff. We're in the field, we're photographing birds one time, and this other photographer comes up to us and recognizes us and everything. And is like, oh, you know, blah, blah, blah. They're standing there talking for a few minutes. And then finally, they look out and they're like, you know, I would really like to be able to photograph those two birds down there. Those two blackneck stilts, essentially, at the edge of the water. And he's like, you know, I haven't been able to do this yet. They keep flying away every time I approach, you know, that sort of stuff. How would you guys approach this? And so I said, you know, just, I'll tell you what, you see that they're slowly but surely feeding in this particular direction. Walk on up the edge of the lake, right? Until you get out ahead of them. You're going to utilize that kind of, you know, edge of vegetation, those bulrushes that are out there, essentially. And, you know, kind of start to slowly but surely walk towards, like angling yourself away from them, walk towards those bulrushes. And once you get about 5-10 feet away, go ahead and drop down to the ground, lay down and slide your lens to where it just starts to poke out of that bulrush right there. And then you'll be nice and low and in position, and those birds are going to continue to work their way in your direction.
Just walk on by.
They're just going to walk right by and you'll get great photographs. These were birds that are habituated to humans anyways. You know what I mean? Like, this was a public park, though. It's not this like extraordinarily wild scenario or anything like that. And the guy is like, yeah. Okay, that makes sense. And so what does he do? He proceeds to like literally blitzkrieg straight towards the two blackneck stilts. You know, didn't veer, didn't go up the lake, didn't adjust his direction or whatever, straight towards the blackneck stilts. The blackneck stilts flew off as soon as he started moving in that
direction.
Yeah,
like within like 4 steps.
Within 4 steps, they're gone. You know what I mean? It's like, again, you're on the other side of the street, somebody's making that blitzkrieg straight towards you, you're going to fly off as well. You know, and this guy, he doesn't even realize that the birds flew off. He busts right through the wall of bulrushes, out to the mud bank on the other side of it, drops his tripod down, you know, into the mud, and then proceeds to literally start yanking vegetation out of the mud and flinging it over his shoulder to get it out of the way of the lens. Then he drops down, wallows all up in the mud behind his lens and gets behind it and then turns around. He's like, oh, where did the birds go? And it's like, well, where do you think the birds went, dude?
As far away from you as possible. That is where they went. And you touched on something that I think is really important as a wildlife photographer, which comes down to the agency, right? Like getting out ahead of the animal or being aware of where they're traveling, etc. That agency aspect for me is extremely important in my work. I don't ever want to feel that I have put an animal into a fight, fright, or freeze situation. Now, we've all had accidental things, you know, where hiking, for example, I was hiking up on the Ice Age Trail a couple of summers ago, and a grouse nearly scared me to death. You know, I'm like 10 miles out on this trail. I haven't seen another human in 3 days. I'm being attacked by mosquitoes. And all of a sudden, this ruffed grouse decides to pop up on the side of the trail. And I thought I was going to have a heart attack because she scared me so badly. Like, we've all accidentally jumped an animal, right?
Yeah, bobwhite quails always
all
get
the time.
Me too.
Yeah, it's just like, you know, we have surprises. But in the case of like the coyote example, or even the stilts that you were just talking about, and the bobcat, all of these things come down to a situation where we're capturing a natural behavior. And that's because we allowed the animal to see us from a far enough away distance that they could decide then and there if they wanted to continue that 100, 200, 300 yards down. And this is another good example of why, like you and I talk about, you know, why we don't always wear camouflage, for example.
Oh gosh, yes.
We get that question a lot, or et cetera. And we've talked a little bit about before the show about how there are absolutely situations where a blind becomes a better tool than just being out in the open, or there are concealment strategies that go into some of the wildlife photography
camo,
that we do.
Clothing, ghillie suits, things like that.
Yeah, and there are like our floating hides, et cetera. And those are all like exceptions to the rule,
they're tools of the trade, but they're definitely the exception to the
rule. And I always think about it as like when I'm asked about that, my general answer is, well, first of all, most of the animals that I photograph are going to smell me long before they see me, and they're going to hear me long before they see me. So I also don't want to be concealed to a point that I startle a bear or startle something that could be a safety problem for me in case maybe they know I'm there, but they have no idea. Like, I don't want to be that concealed. So that's just my personal take. But the agency aspect is really important because that allows us to create a situation where an animal is not boxed in. They don't feel threatened. Their young don't feel threatened, which is a big thing we have to consider in different times of the year. We're not threatening a food source that we're going to take it away from them. And so when we keep in mind all of the things that the animal has to choose on a daily basis that are directly related to their life or death situation in the wild, when we're communicating that none of those things are at risk by our presence, that is a tremendous amount of ease for that animal. And like you said, most of the time, they continue to just walk right toward us and they get curious. They have, you know, they have their own curiosity about us as animals as well. And that has created some of the most beautiful animal encounters that I've ever had, was just being patient and calm and willing to allow that animal to decide whether or not he or she wanted to have an interaction with me. Do they always do that? Absolutely not. But sometimes they get close enough, like your bobcat, where it's a completely benign situation to them and they get to go about their day. And ultimately, I think all of us as wildlife photographers never want to be the person who creates a stressful situation for an animal or creates a situation where now their lives are at risk from another predator because of how we behaved. And this sort of approach that we take and that we teach a lot helps photographers do that, helps remember that being situationally aware to their own agency ultimately is going to yield you not only far better results, but the animal as well.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm going to slide myself out on some very thin ice here for a second, you know, and I'm going to say that this isn't just about creating incredible images of animals, right? This isn't just about, you know, being able to kind of selfishly go out there, create the photographs that you want and then leave again. This is also a matter of ethics too, which I find very interesting. Now, you know, we say this a lot, you know, you and I, we don't bait wildlife. That's just not something that we're into, you
know,
Yeah, it's not our thing in that regards. I'm not going to drag a carcass out into the woods, cut it open, and then allow something to come in. You know what I mean? It's just, it's not what I really want to do for my wildlife photography.
Right.
However, you know, the wildlife photography community as a whole tends to look dimly on the fact that a lot of people do that, that people bait owls, for instance, and stuff like that,
Don't get me started.
Don't get you started. Right, exactly. No, and I completely understand the argument, the ethics, all that sort of stuff. But like, now take a moment and let's juxtapose this, you know what I mean? The intentions and the results, but you know, against what we're talking about now, understanding the animal behavior, letting your, you know, getting set up way in advance, allowing that animal to make a decision, you know, to have the agency to decide whether or not it can come closer versus you suddenly flushing that animal, startling that animal, forcing that animal to flee, which we see over and over and over. And everybody, every single one of us is guilty of at some point in time of doing, but you know, you take that and then you put it up against, say, for instance, somebody, you know, giving a mouse to an owl, essentially, at least the owl got to eat. You know what I mean? I recognize, again, it's like, this is not something we do, but like, the only reason I'm trying to juxtapose this, the only reason I'm even bringing this up is because I think this is a matter of ethics, and I think it's something that nobody ever talks about and should be talking about in terms of the ethics of wildlife photographers. What are we doing with our behavior, regardless of food and stuff like that, in terms of startling, scaring, spooking other species? Terrible, terrible, terrible situation I had one time. I'm responsible for the fact that a black bear got shot and killed. Absolutely 100%. Had no intention to photograph the animal. I didn't even have a camera with me. You know, I was kayaking. All of a sudden, a black bear kind of materializes out of the ether along the edge of this Blackwater Creek in a swamp. I got excited. I stopped instead of just kind of sliding past, you know, silently as the bear was watching me. Instead, I dropped my paddle blade in the water. I turned my boat. I faced directly towards him. Now, all of a sudden, I'm this crazy, different, unique thing that's in the water that's in with my intentions directed towards that black bear turned around and bolted into the swamp. And it was maybe 45 seconds later, maybe a minute later, I heard the report of a rifle and a hunter just so happened to be hunting out in those woods. And I startled that black bear and that black bear was killed, right? Like I said, I wasn't out photographing. I just happened to see this. But our behavior, our actions in the world, the wild world around us have real impacts upon the life and survival and the deaths of animals and stuff like that. And so we need to consider our own behavior, you know, as being one of the most top level ethical considerations day in and day out when we're out there in the woods. And so to your point with the camouflage thing, right? Like, we don't wear camouflage. We'll wear earth tone colors and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. you know, we don't want to go out there wearing a bright blue jacket and bright blue pants and stuff like that because everything's series blue.
Yeah, we're not going out in costume for the to give the animals a show.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, and a lot of predators, for instance, don't see red. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? So yeah. Red is gray. So, you know, you want to wear your black and red checkered buffalo plaid flannel or something like that. It's like, yeah, it's camouflage, basically. It's gray and black for a lot of animals, essentially, right? But, you know, we are mindful in terms of the colors that we're wearing out there. We want the animals in 99.9% of the situations to see what we're doing and to therefore then make a decision as to whether or not we are safe or we are dangerous. And if we are dangerous, but we're dangerous 200 yards away, they're not going to take off fleeing into the forest. They're not suddenly going to explode out of the water and fly off. They're going to just make a nice, slow, casual move off into a different direction. But like I said, most of the time we allow ourselves to be seen. We allow ourselves to kind of get into position and stuff like that and give those animals the opportunity to make a decision to get closer to us. We usually succeed. I would say it's 9 times out of 10, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I would agree with that. And kind of along those lines too, it comes down to another situational awareness, which is what the other photographers, if you're in a place with other photographers, are doing and being aware of their presence as well. And I think about this because I can think of a couple examples when we've been in the field. And like you were talking about this just a few minutes ago, like you see a group of photographers with their lenses out. So, you know, people slam on the brakes, they want to see what the thing is, and all of a sudden the animal leaves. Well, you don't want to ever be the photographer who blows up a shot for another photographer either, or creates a situation where now maybe you have a bank of photographers that have been set up for this hour. They've been photographing this animal. The animal's just, you know, a red fox bouncing and hunting its prey. And then, you know, you don't ever want to be that group or that photographer who comes in and then maybe sets up, you know, parallel or boxes the animal in or creates a situation where now, because this group has amassed, that animal has no escape plan, has no place to go. And suddenly that big open space where it was a calm, you know, nice situation has become crazy zone of all of these human predators with all of their things.
The approaching human zoo.
Yes. Yeah. The movable zoo. You know, you don't want to create a situation where now you are boxing it in. And on top of that, you are also just like screwing it up for everybody else out there. And we've all been in situations where that has either happened to us or we've seen it happen to other people.
Or we've done it ourselves.
Or we've done it ourselves.
Let's be honest. There's sometimes that we accidentally do that sort of stuff ourselves.
I don't think anybody ever is intentionally doing it, but the
no.
You know, intentions are only half as good as actions, I guess you could say. You know, like the action is actually what matters. And so you do need to be aware of calling yourself out on your own behavior. That's something that you just need to do from time to time. And we've all been in that situation. Just a quick flashback, because I know we're giving a lot of examples here, but you and I were doing a trip once where we did exactly like what we've been talking about today. We had a group of folks. We saw some coyotes. They had just paired up and they were coming down the frozen water and they were kind of meandering around together. And we saw the opportunity for what it was, which is, you know, if we drive a quarter of a mile down, half a mile down, and we get everybody out, you know, situated behind this snow-covered log where we're far enough away from the animal, they can just continue on the path, but they're likely going to come around the corner and just come, you know, directly toward us. And we can have this incredible experience with these coyotes. And we were all hunkered down. Everybody was quiet. Everybody was, you know, very still. We were communicating safety in every possible way. And sure enough, those coyotes began walking super, super close, just along, you know, the ridge, maybe, I don't know, what, 30, 50 feet from us, somewhere in there. And all of a sudden, these two non-photographers, they didn't know what they were doing, but we are staring at these two coyotes. And what these two non-photographers, they see our car, they see us down, you know, 50 yards down the hill with our lenses all out. There's a little group of us and they come marching on down the trail and they're like, hey guys, you know, what are you looking at? And what they didn't see.
Meanwhile, there's literally a coyote in between us.
There's literally a coyote right there, like 20 feet from them. And they have no clue that they're even like right there. And that completely jumped the whole situation and completely ruined it for us. And it, you know, like I said, they didn't know. They were excited. And it's really hard when you're somebody who's passionate about how amazing wildlife can be and you want everybody to see everything. It's really, like for me, that is the biggest challenge, is to like give somebody grace when they're not intentionally doing that, because I want people to connect with wildlife in a way they haven't before so badly. But I was like inside, it was like my inner Jinja Ninja was just boiling. And I was like, are you kidding me? We waited for so long. We were there for like 40 minutes and then only to have it, you know, blown up. Yeah. And you don't want to be that those people either. So, you know, just give a little grace to your fellow photographers, but also be situationally aware that, hey, that group might be on something. Like, let's just let it rest right now and give the animal their thing and that group the other thing. And I'm just going to find another opportunity.
Let's kind of like tie this up a little bit, you know, so people that are listening kind of, you know, have something that's sort of a takeaway instead of like, you know, my ranting and raving about ethics or whatever else, right?
Feel free to email Jared directly about that, by the way.
So let's give them a takeaway. What can wildlife photographers do in general to help put animals in ease and therefore kind of increase their success as wildlife photographers? Obviously, learn animal behavior. There's plenty of books out there. You know, spend more time in the field studying instead of just being stuck behind your viewfinder, and you'll start to learn animal behavior that way if you're not a reader, for instance. But you have to learn animal behavior. But in terms of your own behavior, being situationally aware, recognizing that every noise, everything you do, every look you give is being read and communicated in some way, shape, or form, or it's communicating something, I should say, to every animal that is in with eyesight, earshot, or sniff distance,
zone.
I guess.
Yeah.
And some have big sniff zones, like a grizzly bear, for instance. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Going beyond that, don't walk directly towards animals. Don't look directly at animals. You know, when animals stop what they're doing and look at you, that is absolutely 100% of the time for you to kind of like, you know, be that teenager on a cell phone, essentially, you know, kind of like change your direction a little bit, look down at your feet, look around at the sky, do everything possible to communicate your behavior in a different direction and move yourself in the kind of direction of travel that that animal is. Get yourself a couple hundred yards, 200-300 yards out in front of that coyote, bobcat, moose, whatever, you know, whatever the object of your desire is in that regards, and let the animal see you do that. You know, our body posture, you know, how we hold our shoulders, how we swing our tripods around, you know, how we like the speed in which we move, all of that stuff is communicating to those animals. Remember, they have to have this universal language and, you know, in order to be able to exist with inside of these wild communities that they live with inside mm-hmm. of. And when we step into their world, we are instantly engaging with inside of that same two-way conversation with all of those animals that they're doing with each other.
And one of the other things we talk about a lot, not only because it's better photography, is just getting down low.
Sitting down low.
When
so
you sit
important.
Down, and I like to think about it as like we're giving deference to an animal. If you think about it, this is a submissive sort of behavior. It's a calm behavior. You are now no longer like ready to pounce, if you will. You're just sitting there. You're letting the animal know like I'm calm, I'm comfortable. And if you think about that, like I think about the animals when they bed down. You know, I've had a full belly. I'm going to bed down like a moose or a bighorn sheep. Or something along those lines. Or you have, you know, coyotes who aren't hunting curled up on a beautiful little island, you know, or a little spit of land over on the side. Like all of that communicates peacefulness, restfulness, calmness. And so when we get down low, whether it's sitting down low or on our bellies or something like that, that also communicates a specific sort of like, I'm okay. And in fact, I'm more vulnerable than you is another thing that you can communicate with that. Like I'm being vulnerable now. I'm meeting that expectation and I'm fine.
Yeah. And going one step further with that, laying down oftentimes kind of invokes the curiosity of the animals that we're actually photographing. Like I can't
whether
tell
you want it or not.
Whether you yes, and that's the next thing, right? Like, you know, so like I can't tell you how many times working with ungulates, hooved mammals, you know, that laying down suddenly grabs their attention. They recognize I'm a human. They, you know what I mean? Especially in like a national park or something like that, where they see lots of humans. Suddenly a human walks out into their world and lays down, like that's not normal. This is different, but it doesn't seem dangerous, mm-hmm. right? They're not really 100% sure what to make out of it. You know, obviously I'm in a prone position. You know, I'm not in a dangerous position, but they don't understand necessarily what's going on. And so when we do that, oftentimes we can actually, you know, we'll find that like say a buck pronghorn or a bull elk or a bull moose will move over in our direction, pick up their front hoof or their front leg and then stomp and look at us. And then they'll pick it up again and stomp. That makes cool photography, by the way. That's cool behavior right there. To all of a sudden have this like regal, majestic, you know, massive mammal in Yellowstone that's like picking up its leg and then stomping down as it's staring right down the barrel of your lens and stuff. And what they're doing essentially is just like, what is going on over here? This is not what humans are supposed to do.
Yeah, why are you behaving
why are you
this
like,
way?
Are you dead? Did you just walk out here and keel over? You know, so they're stomping to see if they can kind of elicit some sort of behavior or reaction from you. And then obviously not just a Yellowstone thing, you know what I mean?
No, it's all over.
Photograph this, you know, sort of behavior all over the place. But there's a caveat, right? Because there are those species we don't necessarily want to bring about their curiosity. And so I remember taking notes and like I put little asterisks. Don't do this with bears. What my notes say. Don't do this with bears. Bears are very curious on their own.
Oh, I love them.
I love bears. I mean, like, you know, like we could probably make an argument that bears were a big part of luring us up to Alaska.
Yeah. Like and their curiosity is one of the traits that makes me love them so much.
Yes, 100%. So you have to ask yourself, when you're in a close proximity with a 500-pound boar black bear, or you're in close proximity with a brown bear with three cubs, and they're just trying to figure out how to feed their family and survive and all that sort of stuff, do you really want to lure them in to come check you out?
Yeah, not really.
Not really. So there is an opposite side to this coin. While most animals were trying to put at ease and, you know, make them calm so that way we can get close enough to photograph, there are those situations, there are those species that I think it would behoove us to actually mention that maybe that's not the best idea. And sometimes we do want to make ourselves larger and we do want to direct our attention towards them. So that way they recognize there's a boundary. There is a line in the sand that they really shouldn't cross. And, you know, speaking of bears, like one of my all-time favorite examples from a workshop situation, you know the example I'm talking about. You know, we're photographing these black bears and I think it was like the last day of the workshop or something like that. And here's this like, you know, kind of teenage male black bear. Teenagers, just so everybody knows, teenagers are the worst. They're absolutely the worst. They're the ones
especially males.
Yes, I'm so sorry. Teenage males. Apparently we're just going to pick on teenage boys in this whole show.
I guess.
I understand why people used to cross the street when I was walking down the road, but
there you go.
May have had something to do with the blue mohawk and facial piercings and all that sort of stuff at the time. But anyways, we're on this workshop, the looks I'm getting right now. Did you not know I looked like that at one point in time? Choose not to visualize it?
No, I know, and I've visualized it plenty of times.
Okay, I'm sorry. Well, so on this workshop, here's this teenage male. The teenage males, they're still figuring out their place in the world. They're always pushing their boundaries. Every single time I have ever been what we like to refer to as bluff charged by a bear, it's always been a teenage male. It's never been anything else personally. And so, you know, I get everybody into position. They're all laying down on their bellies, lenses out. Here comes this bear, you know, kind of walking directly towards us. And, you know, I'm not shooting. I'm standing up and I'm telling everybody, just stay right here. Nobody moves. This bear is probably going to end up getting too close to photograph. When that happens, don't jump up and try and grab another lens. Just lay there and we're going to allow this bear to pass by us. And then we will get other equipment or we will move and get into a different position. Well, the bear does everything that I expected. The bear comes up. The bear's very interested in us. And like I said, I'm standing up because, you know, I need there to be some sort of barrier between that bear and the photographers laying on the ground.
Yeah.
Well, the bear stops, turns, and then like is looking down at the photographers and starts to walk towards us. Now, understand, walking towards us means that bear's 15 feet and is getting closer now all of a sudden.
Yeah.
And so all I did was I took one step forward, I pointed at the bear and I said, no. And the bear looks at me with like this blue, like Yogi Bear-like face, like, huh? And then turns around and immediately runs off into the woods.
You changed the situation. You created a difference and that told him, danger, I should leave.
Yes. So does a black bear understand the word no? Absolutely not. Does a black bear understand me pointing at the bear? Absolutely not. But once again, universal languages here. Just like getting down low will allow animals to be at ease and maybe coming closer, getting up tall and directing this energy immediately directly towards that animal will also tell them, no, you crossed a line, you need to get back, essentially. And that is exactly what that bear did. As soon as I said no and pointed at that bear, I mean, the look on that bear's face was like, oh shit. And just like immediately bolted into the woods, went around us and popped back out and continued on its way, essentially. And I think that that was the right way to approach that situation. Obviously, we don't want bear coming over and like swatting somebody 600 millimeter or sniffing, you know, the candy bar they have in their back pocket or something.
Yeah, you don't
like
want to create a harmful situation for either the bear or the humans.
Exactly. But every time, once again, cannot repeat this enough. Every time we're in the woods, every time we're in the field, we use the words woods a lot, but you know, there's lots of places, lots of wild places you can photograph animals. Anytime we're in the wild, we are engaged in a two-way conversation at all times. Whether we like it or whether we realize it or not, we are in the middle of a two-way conversation and every animal is communicating with us and everything we do is communicating something with those animals. And so keep that in mind in the field and this will absolutely help you become a significantly better wildlife light photographer.
Yep. At the end of the day, just like you would with any other person or any other being in your world, you have to choose your words and your body language wisely.
Yes, 100%. Well, that's our story on animal behavior, communicating, you know, all the heady stuff about, you know, talking to animals or whatever you want to call it. But if you have any questions about this sort of stuff, I'm going to be completely honest, Annalise, I'm not going to speak for you, but this is one of my favorite topics to discuss.
Me too.
Is ethology, understanding animal behavior, understanding how that we can put ourselves into situations to where we're kind of putting animals at ease. Not only is it an ethical consideration, but it truly does make the difference between extraordinary photographs and, you know, dare I say, butt shots a lot of times.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I have nothing more I could add to that button.
Because of the butt shot?
Yeah. Choose beauty, not butt shots.
Well, what if you like butt shots, though?
Oh, boy.
Okay, I digress. All right, well, thanks for joining us, and until next time. Well, folks, that's a wrap for this episode. Thank you so much for joining us.
You can always find us at photowildmagazine.com, and we really look forward to answering your questions, so send those in at info@photowildmagazine.com. I'm Annalise Kaler.
And I'm Jared Lloyd. See you next time.